This is a reading of a small cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled, What is Anthroposophy? This is lecture 2, entitled The Psychological Perspective, given in Dornach on July 21st, 1923. Anyone in our time, observing spiritual life, cannot fail to see, and it takes only a sufficiently unprejudiced eye, how soul has, on the whole, more or less been lost, as far as the most important aspects of our culture are concerned. This disappearance has been increasingly evident since the second half of the 19th century. In a word, soul is missing in our contemporary civilization, and the individual who wants to awaken his or her soul to an inner life must do so in solitude rather than in the shared experience of the great monuments of our civilization. Generally speaking, we have lost the ability to be awake to the fundamental drift of present-day life. Things have happened that the kind of objective observation that started in the 19th century should have noticed. By rights, these things should have called for powerful attention to what was happening in our spiritual life. In reality, however, such phenomena are more and more allowed to pass by unnoticed. Even more, we can honestly say that they have never received any formulation in recent times that could make an impression deep enough to awaken anyone today. To begin my observations today, I would like to present a phenomenon that, seen from the outside, will perhaps be greeted by some with a smile. Others will simply register it neutrally as one historical philosophical error among many. Still others will perhaps fight it angrily. I will try to give as simple a description of the facts as I can. In the last two decades of the 19th century, I often asked myself an important question: who is really the most intelligent person of my time? Of course, these things are always relative. So I shall ask you not to press the issue too hard and take it with a grain of salt. Having done this, I still ask you, however, to consider this question as one that can tell us something characteristic of our age. Our age is the age of intellectualism. The intellect has brought our age to its quite exceptional height. And so one must wonder, what does the human intellect actually depend on during earthly existence? Certainly, intellectual powers and activity depend on the soul. Later, we have to take a closer look at the soul as such. For the moment, however, let us say they depend on the etheric organism, formative force body, astral body, and capital I organization that human beings consciously, at least as far as earthly consciousness is concerned, bear within themselves. But human beings are not so far advanced in the present period of earthly evolution that they can really bring into existence the activity of the intellect as it lives in these three parts of human nature. Without a physical body, our intellect would be silent during earthly existence. We would be like a person moving toward a wall. As soon as we move straight ahead, without looking at our arms and hands, we see nothing of ourselves. But if the wall we are walking toward is a mirror, we see ourselves. Without a body, the human intellect would be like a person who does not see himself or herself. In other words, if we did not have a physical body to mirror or reflect our activity, we would not be aware of ourselves. We owe the greatness of the intellect in the present time to the mirroring of our inner soul activity through our physical bodies. People do not normally confuse their mirror image with their self, but this does happen in the case of the intellect. People confuse the intellect itself with its reflection in the physical realm. They surrender to the reflection, with the result that the reflection or mirror image itself then rules them. To some extent, human beings today give the intellect wholly over to their physical body. When a person really succeeds in this, it produces a great perfection of the intellect. If, on the other hand, we allow our inner being to be active, we find ourselves always stumbling through all kinds of feelings and instincts, prejudices, sympathies and antipathies. We blunder into the intellect in the same way. Then the intellect is very imperfect. However, if we allow ourselves to become dry, sober, and cold-natured, and in the process acquire a capacity to think in a way that is determined by the parameters of our physical body, then we attain a certain perfection of the intellect. We learn to think in such a way that the intellect becomes self-moving, to some sense, to some extent, automatic, and relatively perfect. As Hämmerling describes it in his novel titled Homunculus, we unite, quote, the billionaire's male soullessness with the mermaid's female soullessness, close quote. This is what I was thinking in the last decades of the 19th century when I asked myself, who is the most intelligent person today? Who has raised his intellect to a level of perfection in the sense that I have just described? Now, you may laugh, but I really could not come up with anyone other than Edward von Hartmann, the philosopher of the unconscious. This is not some kind of daring paradox, but rather something that came to me as the result of long and, I don't think entirely soulless, reflection on the last decades of the 19th century. You can well imagine that having declared someone the most intelligent person of the age, you gain a great deal of respect for that person. That is why I dedicated my little book titled Truth and Knowledge, which was my contribution to a theory of knowledge in those days, to Edward von Hartmann. What I am saying here, therefore, is said out of the deepest respect, not disrespect. The foundations of von Hartmann's philosophy are determined in the first place by the fact that he was trained as a military officer. He reached the rank of first lieutenant. But then he developed knee problems. Thus it came about that he transformed the intellectualism that had been intended to serve the modern military into philosophy. It is interesting that this is precisely how von Hartmann became the cleverest man of the last third of the 19th century. He saw clearly everything that a person could see clearly with the mind of the last third of the 19th century. He penetrated human consciousness as it is attached to the earth. But he saw this attachment as the attachment to a human physical body. Because he was clever, he did not deny the spirit. As I said, he was very intelligent. However, he placed the spirit in the sphere of the unconscious, in what can never support a body or enter into intimate union with the physical world, and which, therefore, because it is always extra-physical, that is, purely spiritual, can only be unconscious. Von Hartmann thought we could be conscious only in the body. But if the body is not the only reality, if there is spirit, then the spirit can never be conscious, only unconscious. Therefore, von Hartmann says that when we pass through the gate of death, we should not expect to enter a different state of consciousness. Beyond earthly consciousness is only unconsciousness. When we die, we pass into the sphere of the unconscious spirit. The unconscious spirit is everywhere. Human consciousness is not. In this sense, von Hartmann's philosophy is a philosophy of the spirit, but a philosophy of the unconscious spirit. There is no consciousness other than in a human body, but there is spirit everywhere, unconscious spirit that knows nothing of itself, or of the world, or of anything else. It is quite clear, then, is it not, that this unconscious spirit can never penetrate any reality outside itself except through a physical human body? This is clear from the outset. But saying that implies something quite remarkable. The implication is that the intellect that rises to establish the unconscious lacks love. I am not saying that Edward von Hartmann lacked love, but that his intellect, which is precisely where his importance lay, lacked love. Now, a loveless intellect cannot build any bridges. It is locked into itself. But by that token, it cannot acquire consciousness. It remains in the sphere of the unconscious. Or, one could say, it remains in the sphere of lovelessness. This implies that the intellect is also a sphere of soullessness. Wherever there is no place for love, anything of a soul nature gradually disappears. Hence we can sense of an atmosphere of lovelessness in the best productions of the late 19th century, on whose shoulders our own civilization now stands. It is astonishing to see where von Hartmann's compulsion toward the unconscious spirit, coupled with lovelessness, led him. He observed the world of earthly life that gives humanity consciousness. But what if we are not able to live in our bodies? What if every time we woke up, we were not able to submerge into our bodies and completely unite with them? What would be our prospect then? When we awaken from sleep as earthly beings, the capital I in the astral body, separated during sleep, return into the physical and etheric bodies. The I and astral body then unite in full inner union with the etheric and physical bodies. These four now make one. As long as we are awake, we must speak of an inner unity of spirit and soul with the physical and bodily. But if we separate the soul spirit from the physical body, as von Hartmann does intellectually, it would be as if, on awakening, we were to penetrate into our physical and etheric bodies without melting into them, permeating, but only, as it were, dwelling, hovering there. According to von Hartmann, the unconscious spirit dwells in the body and becomes conscious in and through physical earthly life. Therefore, he seems to think something that, were it to happen in reality, would mean that when we are awake, we enter our physical and etheric bodies without completely merging with them. This would be rather like living in our bodies as in a house. We could be looking around, checking everything out, but remain inwardly separated, inwardly cut off. What would happen then? If our spirit soul were not merged with our physical body, but instead lived cut off from it, our soul would experience unfathomable, intolerable pain. Pain arises when an organ does not function correctly, and the organ becomes sick, and we are excluded from a part of our physical body. If we were kept out altogether, we would, if I may put it this way, literally be, quote, extra physical, close quote, out of the body, and we would suffer unspeakable pain. Each morning when we wake up, the threat of this suffering is to some extent present. We overcome it by submerging into our physical and etheric bodies and uniting ourselves with them. Von Hartmann was certainly no initiate. He was simply an intellectual, the best intellectual of the second half of the 19th century. He grasped intellectually in his thoughts what I have just described to you as a reality. He imagined the world as if our astral body and I were not connected with our physical and etheric body. He thought of the relationship between the person and the physical body as I have just described in the light of reality. Where did this lead him? This led him in the end to a radical pessimism. Obviously, you would experience pessimism if you woke up separated from your physical body. Von Hartmann thought this. It was his invention. And what was the result? He concluded that the world is the worst imaginable. The world contains the greatest heap of evil and suffering. And the true cultural evolution of humanity can consist only in the gradual annihilation, dissolution of the world. Accordingly, at the end of titled The Philosophy of the Unconscious, an ideal begins to emerge. Von Hartmann lived in an age in which technology was developing rapidly. More and more machines were being invented to deal with this or that. Anyone considering everything that machines can accomplish will be fascinated by the possibilities they offer. Now, if we expand the possibilities that the perfecting of the mechanical world promises for the world, a horrifying possibility suggests itself. Von Hartmann gave himself over to this horrifying thought. He thought that humanity, which, because it is reaching the intellect, is gradually becoming more and more intelligent, would increasingly come to see that the right thing for the world would be to annihilate it. He became convinced that humanity eventually would invent a new machine. With this machine, it would be possible to bore right through to the center of the earth. Then one had only to put this machine into motion in order with a single blow to blast this terrible earth with all its physical inhabitants into cosmic space. We can only say that the roots of this way of thinking are actually present in everyone else too. They may not be as smart as von Hartmann was, but they are still quite smart enough, though they lack the intellectual courage to draw the final consequences of their own logic. And one might almost say that if we seriously consider all that intellect can achieve when it is separated from the rest of the world, then this ideal that von Hartmann proposes, which is a result of one-sided intellectual development, appears as in a certain sense necessary. I said earlier that people did not manage to describe correctly some phenomena of the time that were there for everyone to see. This, of course, would have required at least rising to the precise formulations of the philosopher of the unconscious who described this perspective in 1869. And von Hartmann was really more intelligent in this than anyone else. For after he had proposed his ideal, he did something that I have often described. In the same book in which he proposed his ideal, he spoke of the spirit. Even if it was unconscious, still it was the spirit. This was a horrible sin at the time, because science had developed to the point that scientifically one was not permitted to speak of the spirit, not even in the rather harmless way of making the spirit completely unconscious. For this reason, other intelligent people of the time saw, titled The Philosophy of the Unconscious, which was successful as literature, as dilettantism. But then von Hartmann played a trick on them. An unknown author published an attack against the philosophy of the unconscious, which thoroughly refuted the philosophy of the spirit. The title of this work was The Unconscious from the Standpoint of Physiology and the Theory of Evolution. This anonymous work was a remarkable parody of the style of other scholars. The best natural scientists of the time, Oscar Schmidt, Ernst Haeckel, and a host of others, wrote most laudatory reviews of the book, declaring that with this book, the dilettante Edward von Hartmann had really been destroyed. What a shame, they said, that we don't know who this anonymous author was. Tell us who you are, and we shall accept you as one of us. Not surprisingly, after this clarion call, the book by Anonymous soon sold out, and a second edition became necessary. It appeared under the title The Unconscious from the Standpoint of Physiology and the Theory of Evolution, second edition by Edward von Hartmann. As you can see, Edward von Hartmann had proven that he really was the smartest, for he was not only as smart as he himself was, he was as smart as his opponents. Yesterday I had to say that psychoanalysis was dilettantism squared. Today, we might say, because soul qualities always multiply themselves, that von Hartmann's intelligence was intelligence squared, intelligence multiplied by itself. Surely we ought not to sleep through such phenomena the way we do nowadays. We should be able to formulate them and hold them before souls. Then we would actually face the absurdities of our age. What was it that made Edward von Hartmann so intelligent? He was so intelligent because his unblinking gaze had really looked at everything that was possible to notice in his time. He was, as it were, the natural scientist of philosophy. Approaching such a phenomenon, it is a question of being completely and empirically clear about what must be done to avoid falling into the same abyss. If we wish to find a way out of the chaos facing us in our civilization, we must take a close look at what we actually bear within us. If we really start out from the human physical body and then move toward the spirit, we begin to approach the soul. In doing so, we meet the etheric or formative force body. Like everyone else in his time, von Hartmann had no concept of this etheric or formative force body. He never rose from the observation of external natural physical reality to the reality that borders the physical, that is, the etheric formative force body. We know that when we enter sleep, the astral body and the eye separate from the physical and etheric bodies. The etheric body remains behind in the physical body. In fact, we can never know how the etheric body is constituted with only our earthly consciousness. For when we awake, our astral body and I submerge into the etheric body. Then we are inside. We experience what was brought in by the astral body and the I. It would take a much more highly organized being to enter into the etheric body during sleep, when the I and astral body are outside it. A being truly able to observe objectively how the etheric body actually operates would discover exactly what it is we leave behind with the physical body as etheric body when we go to sleep. If we were to investigate what we leave behind, we would find that the etheric or formative force body is in reality the paragon of all wisdom in the earthly sense, and in much higher senses too. From the perspective of true knowledge, then, we cannot deny that when we leave our physical and etheric bodies behind at night, the two that we leave behind are much more intelligent than we are when we inhabit them. After all, as far as our eye and astral body are concerned, we are respectively children of the more recent earth and moon stages of the evolution of the earth. On the other hand, the etheric body goes back to the earlier evolutionary stage of the sun, and the physical body goes back to the first evolutionary stage of Saturn. These so-called sun and Saturn stages, therefore, stand on a much higher level of perfection. We cannot today, in our eye and in astral body, measure ourselves against the sum of wisdom amassed by our etheric body in the course of its sun evolution. One might put it this way: the etheric body is concentrated wisdom. But if we wish to bring the wisdom of the eye and the astral body into the etheric body, then we need something to oppose to it, a counterfoil, just as we need the counterpart of a mirror in order to see the mirror image at all. We need the physical body, just as we could not stand if we did not have physical ground to stand on, so we could not live in our etheric body if the etheric body did not border on the physical body and bump into it on all sides. If the etheric body did not have a counterpart in the physical body, we could not live in our etheric body. The etheric body's inner life would float suspended in the air. Thus, we have a soul life that lives in the etheric body, and which for ordinary earth life requires the physical body as a support. With this state of the soul, we can reach only to the mineral world. We can penetrate only what is without life. To reach the plant world, we need the ability to use the etheric body without the physical body. How do we do that? How can we learn to use our etheric body without the physical body? We can do it if gradually, by means of inner exercises, we transform ourselves from beings who prefer, because of their physical bodies, to live in the element of gravity, into beings who learn by means of the light to live in the element of lightness or levity. We must transform ourselves through the light into beings that no longer experience their connection with the earth, but feel connected to the cosmic spaces. Gradually, the contemplation of the stars, the sun, moon, and cosmic space must become as familiar to us as plants growing in the meadow. If we are merely children of the earth, we look down onto the plants covering the meadow. We enjoy them, but we don't understand them, for we remain earth beings weighed down by gravity. As earthlings bound by gravity, we have learned to stand on the earth. But if we could transform ourselves, we could connect ourselves with the widths of cosmic space, those meadows of the heavens seeded with stars. In our present state of consciousness, we think of the heavens as a ceiling rather than a floor. But once they become as familiar to us as the ground of the earth beneath our feet, then we can begin, as we change earth consciousness into cosmic consciousness, to learn to use our etheric body as we previously learned to use our physical body. Only then will we become capable of penetrating the plant world with our understanding. For plants are not so much pushed up out of the earth as they are pulled out of the earth by the sky. Goethe was filled with this yearning when he wrote his essay on the Metamorphosis of Plants. He said many things that a person would say who felt himself oriented to the sun rather than to the earth, a person who felt that the sun pulls the force of the plant's growth out of the earth when it is still hidden under the ground. He felt how the sun's forces, interacting with the influence of the air, gradually develop the leaf, and how the sun then slowly cooks the elements that the plant sucks out of the earth. Read Goethe's wonderful 1790 essay, and you will find approaches to this view on every page. Goethe lived in the desire to penetrate the world of the plants, but instead of developing etheric vision in place of physical vision, Goethe only stumbled on it, repeatedly. All the same, this impulse to develop etheric vision was already present in Goethe, and anyone wishing to learn from Goethe, the living Goethe whose influence is ongoing, not the dead one, must take this impulse further. Once we understand that human souls can develop etheric vision, for this we need only become truly conscious of the etheric body, we will be able to perceive our heavenly origins and independence from the earth. We will be able to understand that we have been transplanted onto earth. Then our soul will be able to say, quote, "I am of cosmic origin. My physical body transplants me onto the earth, but my origin is cosmic. And if I can rejoice in the world of plants, what rejoices in me is a child of heaven, who rejoices in seeing what the heavens draw out of the earth in the plant world." Close quote. When we truly grasp our etheric or formative force body, we rescue our souls from the earth. If we can do that, if we are able to live in the etheric body just as we usually live in the physical body, and what can bring us there is true love for the plant world, it is not only our own etheric body that is raised into consciousness. As the physical world is raised into our consciousness by our physical body, by our senses, so the etheric world is placed in our consciousness by our etheric body. And what would we sense if, just as we look out into the physical world with our physical body, we looked into the etheric world through the etheric body? What would we behold then? We would see the past of all the things spread out before our physical eyes, the actual past from which this physical world arose. We would see, in the spirit, the images of what was, of what made the present possible. Already in most ancient times, the first initiation given to humanity was an initiation into the cosmos. The first mystery schools worked on this initiation into the cosmos. The teachers of these first mysteries initiated their students into reading in the cosmic ether, also called, quote, reading in the chaos, close quote, quote, reading in the Akashic Chronicle, close quote. That is to say, the reading of the past that the present conjures up before our eyes. For practical purposes, this initiation by the cosmos was the first level of initiation that humanity achieved in its earthly existence. A second level of initiation may likewise be attained. This happens if, when we awake, we allow the astral body and the eye to sink into the physical and the etheric bodies. We, in quotes, ensoul the etheric and physical bodies. We unite ourselves with them. However, we can gain only as much of the infinite wisdom of the etheric body as we ourselves carry into it. Nevertheless, it is the etheric body that constantly stimulates us. Whenever we have a good intuition, it is the etheric body, which is inwardly connected with the cosmos, that stimulates this intuition. We receive all the intuitions, all the genius we develop when we are awake, from the etheric body, by way of the universe. Whenever the etheric body stimulates the astral body, our genius converses with the universe. Even if we cannot see these things, we still live within them. Our soul life always consists in our astral body and our eye sinking, in the waking state, into our physical and etheric bodies. Once the stars are as much home to us as are the meadows, to the extent that we make the cosmic space the ground of our being on high, we are able to experience the etheric world. In reality, we always experience the etheric. Without initiation, however, we cannot penetrate it cognitively. Nevertheless, in actuality, every human being experiences the etheric world. If we are looking for an opposing counterpart for the astral body, that counterpart, the etheric body, is always there. It is just a matter of spiritual science calling our attention to what is present in every human being. Let me give you an example. Let us say that you could not see the floor beneath you, but you were nevertheless standing on it. Then you would in fact be standing on it, although you knew nothing of it. Then let's say that someone, by scientific means, were to demonstrate that the floor is there, and were to tell you so. You would still be standing on the floor as you always were. In the same way, someone who knows spiritual science could tell you that your astral body reaches up to the upper floor, the floor of the stars. But actually, irrespective of what he has just said, you already do so. You already reach to the stars. In other words, as human beings with astral bodies, we already live in another world, in the world of living spiritual beings that we have described as the world of the higher hierarchies. When we are in the physical world, we look at things from this perspective. Reality, then, is the physical world in which there are minerals, plants, animals, and a ground to stand on, a world out of which the human being arose as the latest thing in the course of evolution. By the same token, human beings, by virtue of their astral bodies, dwell in the world of higher hierarchies. Simply by inhabiting the world, we have the counterfoil appropriate to the astral body. We always carry within us what we learn from spiritual science. And of course, we do so independently of its teaching. And we always bear within us the capacity to feel. Whatever we can make our own from the world through our feelings, through this innermost life of the soul, is actually the welling up and weaving of the higher spiritual hierarchies in our astral body. Naturally, whenever we become conscious of our feelings, this experience itself is the immediate object of our perception, but the feeling itself is the weaving and working of the higher spiritual hierarchies through us. We cannot really grasp or understand soul unless we experience it immersed in the spiritual worlds of the higher hierarchies. You know that the past is unveiled to our present senses by etheric vision whenever I give a contemporary description of what was communicated in the first earthly mysteries as the initiation into the cosmos. In the same way, the soul can be deepened so that it becomes conscious of what is happening in the astral body. This requires loving absorption in all that lived in the great mysteries as the relationship to the spiritual worlds. If we allow ourselves to be taught by the cosmos under the guidance of the wisdom of initiation, we reach the first level of the soul's reality. Once we penetrate what actually took place in the mysteries, we can read in the so-called Akashic record not only the past of the stars, the earth, and humanity, we can also read what lived in the very souls of the great teachers of these mysteries. We can make what I tried to describe to you entitled Christianity as Mystical Fact live within us. We can bring to life what these teachers developed out of themselves in their work with the spiritual beings. In doing so, we shall approach the initiation that in later times was added to cosmic initiation. This I would call the initiation of the sages. Thus we may speak of two levels of initiation, through the cosmos and through the sages. What the sages taught as cosmic knowledge formed the content of cosmic initiation. Looking into the souls of those who came before us in the human soul life leads to the second level of the soul's being. To enter this sphere, we can begin with outer history. We can seek to grasp and understand in an inwardly living way what still shines down to us from ancient times. The contents, for instance, of the remarkable wisdom of the Vedanta or other ancient wisdom teachings. Doing so, we actually begin to grasp our own inner life and thereby begin to approach cosmic initiation. And if we become truly and lovingly absorbed in such things, as I did in Christianity as Mystical Fact, where I explained the relationship between the contents of the old mysteries and the mystery of Golgotha, then we begin to approach the sages' initiation. The present age calls for one thing, and that is to look honestly into our own interiority and come to know impartially our own spirit. The spirit that illuminates the soul from inside, as it were. I shall return to this later, when I describe it as the third level of the initiation required in our time, the initiation of self-knowledge. When spiritual science speaks of the soul, it must speak out of the spirit of these three levels of initiation, by the cosmos, by the sages, by self-knowledge. In doing so, it traverses the different boundaries of soul life. But it is impossible to begin to take even the first steps on this path without love. Here I must stress that it is precisely the present-day intellect that forgets love, loses love when it reaches its heights. Because of this, something quite particular happens. To penetrate with love, the realities described as physical body, astral body, etheric body, and I, we need to absorb something of the voice of the ruling spirit of our age. We need the goodwill to listen carefully to the voice of the genius or spirit of our time. But can human beings today really take in with the necessary seriousness what is meant by the words, quote, the genius of our time, close quote? For most people, is it anything more than an abstract phrase? Just try and think how remote from the understanding of true spiritual living reality people really are, and how little they know what they are really saying when they speak of the genius of our time. Although human beings may deny the spirit, they cannot get rid of it. The spirit is inalterably connected to humanity. When human beings fail the genius of their age, the demon of the age steps in. We can understand what happens in such cases by considering what happened in the last third of the 19th century. This was a time when the human intellect was able to follow the mechanism of physical life in its most intimate detail. In the process, the intellect itself became automatic, mechanical. Thereby it reached its highest development. It became so clever, it reached the apogee of intelligence. But no matter how clever it became, it brought to existence only the mechanical, the materialistic, in the intellect. The intellect conducted itself as humanity does when it refuses the genius of the age. Therefore the human intellect fell prey to the demon of the age. Separated from the soul, it became mechanical, soulless, and on that foundation it built a philosophy. It had no love. It could not love wisdom. Its philosophy could only become the intellectual replica of terrestrial demonology, a demonology that can conceive the ideal of a machine boring right through to the center of the earth and blasting the world into cosmic space. This was the demon of the age, speaking to the intellect of the age. Often when we do not wish to know the soul, it is the demon of the age that we hear. The soul then appears to the intellect as it would to us if, on awakening, we plunged into our physical and etheric bodies, but did not unite with them and remained separated from them. Such an intellect is foreign to the very being of humanity, for it has freed itself from what it means to be human. An intellect united with the being of humanity grows from earthly consciousness up to other states of consciousness. An intellect that connects itself to the earth and then cuts itself off from it is only the mirror image of the intellect. For such an intellect, all other states of consciousness are part of the unending ocean of unconsciousness. Then the human soul ceases to be conscious of its heavenly origin and loses the awareness of its autonomy in relation to earthly life. But the human soul is characterized by the fact that in our time we oscillate between bodily and spiritual realities. Human soul life consists in this movement between the bodily and the spiritual. If we honestly believe only in the body and cannot let go of the spirit altogether, then the spirit merely becomes unconscious, and thereby we deny the soul. Hartmann envisioned the downfall of the earth demonically. He did so only as a person could, who was asleep in his physical body, and became, as it were, clairvoyant in it. At the very time that Hartmann was coming to his intellectual interpretation of earthly suffering, another man, who was his friend and exchanged many letters with him, lay on a sickbed. His body was racked with pain. Many organs of his soul spiritual being could not gain access to his physical body. This man had the actual experience of earthly suffering. He did not just think about it. And for him the only way to deal with the soullessness of the age seemed to be satire. The man was Robert Hemmerling, who in the 1880s wrote a book called Homunculus, in which he allowed the perspective on a soulless age to dawn. He created the image of a man who strives in all external matters, amasses more and more material goods, and eventually becomes a billionaire. Such was the frightening vista that Hemmerling contemplated with the eye of his soul. The soulless billionaire, the homunculus, who comes into the world in a purely mechanical way, without the soul's collaboration, marries the soulless elemental spirit, the mermaid, Lorelei. For Hemmerling, the perspective of a soulless zeitgeist came to life in the form of a man whose striving focused entirely on the material realm, a striving for spiritless intellectualism. Such spiritless intellectualism is present in nature spirits, but its presence in human beings awakens the forces of destruction. The demonic forces of destruction whose ambition it is to blow up the entire world. For Robert Hemmerling, the only way to deal with the problem of soullessness was satire. We must restore soul to modern civilization and culture. But we can do so, we can only give the world soul, when the light of spiritual knowledge illuminates human experiences on earth. Thus, what the cleverest person of our age presented in a truly terrifying, repulsive manner, and what a man who was racked in pain and saw the tragedy of this cleverness presented in satirical form, this is what humanity must transform, through spiritual knowledge, into the soul's perspective. I spoke yesterday of the physical perspective. Today I wanted to speak of the soul's perspective. Tomorrow I shall speak of the spiritual perspective. The end of Lecture 2.